Today's program has been brought to you by White Oak Pastures, a five-generation Georgia-based beef and poultry farm determined to conduct business in an honorable manner. For more information, visit whiteoakpastures.com. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Hello, everybody. My name is Patrick Martins. This is a live edition of the main course, unless it's being played in the future, in which case it is not a live edition, but it's live right now. It's March 31st, 2013. It's my mother's birthday. Happy birthday. I think she was born in like 1976 or something like that. And I am really happy to be here. I really want to thank White Oak Pastures for sponsoring us. And thank Joe for coming in and engineering. Hey, Joe.
Hello, Patrick. How's it going?
I can only hear out of one ear. So is that you in there, or is that just these mic?
Might be the headphones.
Headphones, yeah. Well, anyway, this is a big day. We're going to have a good show today. We're going to talk to Jonathan Justice, who owns a Justice drugstore, a very good restaurant in a very small town in Missouri, kind of near Kansas City, but, you know, a lot closer to Trimble. The town is Smithville. And, you know, it's part of this trend of good chefs and new restaurants opening in places other than the downtowns of big cities. So it's kind of like the America becoming more of a foodie place. So today is Easter. Happy Easter, Joe. Joe, you there?
I'm here.
Happy Easter.
Happy Easter to you.
So what happened? Jesus revived from the dead, right? Today?
That's what happened.
So
they say.
Today, yeah, no, I'm pretty sure it happened. So I think today, to honor that, I will predict the future. Because, you know, the future, they say he's going to come again. And, you know, it's just a time to reflect, but also to look towards the future. Jesus being, born for a second time. So I thought I would predict what the food world is going to look like in the year 2222. Have you ever thought that far, Joe? Is that far ahead?
No, I don't think I have. But,
because if you had a son right now, let's say you impregnated your girlfriend and he was born in 9 months, he would live to at least the year 2100.
Yeah, probably.
And his son would probably live to the year 2150. Yes, his son would live to the year 2200. So that's your grandson. No, that's your great-grandson.
My great-grandson.
Will live to 20. And his son will be, you know, a little bit older than middle-aged in the year 2222. So I was thinking, what would things look like in the year 2222? And I have Joe, who's going to help me with a beautiful sound effect. All right, let's begin.
In the year 2222.
I think that there's going to be a lot more citrus and even coffee grown in the United States. Global warming trends are basically going to allow those types of foods, bananas, oranges, and, you know, coffee beans, you know, to be, you know, those are traditionally things that are grown, I think, a little bit closer to the equator or in hotter temperature areas. So now I think that's going to move north, helping further spiral countries like Brazil and African countries, you know, into kind of a state of chaos, because now we'll be producing foods. And for foods that do not grow well in hotter environments, you know, maybe we're going to have to change our agricultural traditions here. And the crops that we used to rely on, maybe we won't rely on as much if temperatures keep going up. So for nutrients, we will get more accustomed to eating pills that contain all the nutrients for the foods that we can no longer raise.
In the year 2222.
Big farms in states will actually specialize in certain foods. So all the oranges will be grown, you know, in certain states. All the tomatoes will be grown in certain states. And they'll kind of be specialization of certain foods. So each state will become much more, especially farm states, much more associated with intensive crops of certain foods. But I think that the most diverse farms will occur, will basically pop up very close to big cities in protected tents or on roofs, like our friend Ben Flanner in the Brooklyn Grange. You know, and cities will fuel these crops, these diverse crops, and the farmers who man these farms will come from different countries like Vietnam or Mexico, and they will start raising foods that are traditionally grown there for personal reasons, but it will help to diversify the cuisines and the ingredients available in big cities.
In the year 2222,
a new fad diet will be the prairie tall grass diet, where individuals eat certain edible variety of wild plants that the earth grows on its own in places like the Flint Hills of Kansas. And we will actually return a little bit more to the foods that the American Indians ate. And on the meat level, steaks are essentially going to become once-a-year items. You know, you won't no longer see the Outback, you know, pushing steaks quite as much. I mean, steaks are going to be a much more rare delicacy in the year 2222. And instead of big, like 18-ounce steaks and steakhouses in every city, you're going to see a lot more kind of curries, stews, goat is going to appear on menu. Lamb, you know, will be eaten ground lamb like they do in Middle Eastern restaurants, you know, the kibbeh, and, you know, meatballs and ragu sauce and things like that, you know, that involve ground up meat are going to become much more popular. But the chicken will actually, an unbelievable revolution will happen around the chicken. And it'll almost be like it'll be sold and traded much like tulips were in Holland, I think in the 1600s, where there were these huge bidding wars and like stock market systems growing for how they would deal with tulip markets. Michael Pollan writes that about that in his book, Botany of Desire. And it will, I think poultry will become the new tulip, and everyone will be breeding their own breeds on their rooftops, in their homes. They'll be buying breeders for thousands and thousands of dollars. They're going to be poultry shows. They're going to be magazines dedicated to who and which city actually, you know, is responsible for the best chickens. It's going to be almost like the Johnny Appleseed movement for apples. And, you know, the reason, of course, is that chickens are easy to grow and they're going to, you know, reach much better gastronomic heights thanks to the future.
In the year 2222,
restaurant culture will change. Certain areas like that traditionally housed great restaurants won't even really have that much business. For instance, downtown Manhattan, rising water will push a lot of those restaurants out of those neighborhoods. And, you know, a little bit upstate, maybe 45-minute, one-hour drive north, you know, on higher land. And you're not only going to have great restaurants concentrated in certain few neighborhoods. And what will pop up in the city are kind of mess hall, kind of like German beer garden restaurants, you know, where hundreds of people can sit at long benches and long tables. And I do predict that beer will surpass wine as the kind of beverage of choice at these restaurants. And I think that chefs and farmers will be counted in the census counts in the same category. You know, because chefs will essentially have to be farmers too. And they'll like own lots in the various agricultural spaces on roofs and stuff like that. And each restaurant will have its little, you know, 10 meter by 10 meter spot and can grow on it whatever it would like. So I don't know. I kind of think that, you know, that's an interesting prediction of the future. And I will say this, franchises will actually become good things. You will see, you know, an evolution of all these businesses, whether it be Heritage Foods or Saxo Beef Cheesemongers or the Meat Hook, you know, all these places will start to open up various outlets. And then you're going to have, basically, franchises is going to become a good word because it's going to be from slow ethic businesses. And you're going to see ballparks and universities actually have better food thanks to this growth of, you know, artisan franchises. And McDonald's will no longer have a consistent product around the world because it's not going to be able to marshal the forces like it is, you know, as it soils the nest. It's not going to be able to marshal those forces anymore. So they're going to have to rely on more regional acquisition of meats and working with regional slaughterhouses. And that's going to make their cheeseburgers taste a little bit different in each place. They're going to fall in stature here and rise in the third world. But in the year 2422, they'll be phased out of there as well. And Golden Arches will only be used rather than to advertise a restaurant, just to prop up organic food tents that are grown in cities around the world. So what do you think, Joe? Any of that possible?
I think a lot of that's pretty possible.
All right. Well, thank you. That was very, very nice. Very nice sound effect. And I'm really excited that... if anyone is still listening, it'd be a miracle, but that would be very exciting. And I will take a short break, and then we're going to call in with Jonathan Justice of Justice Drugstore in Smithville, Missouri.
White Oak Pastures is the only farm in the United States that has its own USDA-inspected red meat abattoir or slaughterhouse and its own USDA-inspected poultry abattoir or slaughterhouse. We partner with Whole Foods to deliver our high-quality meat and poultry from Miami, Florida, all the way to Princeton, New Jersey. One family, one farm, five generations, 145 years. Full circle return to sustainable land stewardship and humane animal stockmanship. For more information, please visit our website, whiteoakpastures.com.
You're listening to Home of Emptiness by Pamela Royal on the heritageradionetwork.org.
Wow, Jonathan Justice, don't take that the wrong way. Home of Emptiness. God, what a song name. But welcome to Heritage Radio Network. Hello, hello.
Yeah, hey, Patrick, how are you doing?
Hey, Jonathan, how's it going over there?
Oh, it's going fine. It's going fine. It's a beautiful day.
So tell me, where are we calling? Because we want to know exactly the terroir in which the chef lives that we're going to be talking to for the next 15, 20 minutes.
I would say, in the broadest of terms, flyover country, more specifically, in the very center, Smithville, Missouri. Actually, I live in Paradise, Missouri, which is a little village of about 20 homes in rural Clay County, Missouri, outside of Kansas City.
And why do they call it Paradise? I mean, is that the same reason why Paradise Locker Meats, the famous Heritage abattoir, is called Paradise?
Yeah, absolutely. Paradise Meats used to be about a block from where I live, and when they outgrew their facility, they moved over to the much larger ville of Trimble, which is all of about 500 people.
Yeah, 500 people. Paradise, yeah, they doubled in size.
There's a story that says Paradise used to be called Ogdenville, and the postmaster at the time said there were so many churches in the little village that it should be called Paradise.
How many churches per person?
I think back then it was probably how many churches per person? How about people per church? Not much more than 10 or 15.
Wow.
Like I said, there's only, I don't know how many people live here. Maybe 40, 50 people live in this village, and there used to be 1, 2, 3, 4 churches. There's still 2 churches remaining. This is the northern edge of the Bible Belt.
Northern edge of the Bible Belt. And, of course, in a few minutes, we're going to talk about how your family had a pharmacy there and you converted it into a critically acclaimed award-winning restaurant. But let's still stick with this terroir thing. So I know there's a big thing called Smithville Lake and a certain fish come out of there. But tell us one more step into the terroir. Temperatures, what's grown there? Is it mostly agricultural? Just to kind of contextualize where you are cooking, because I know it's very important for you to use the local resources you have. So explain what those are.
Well, this is an area that is fairly extreme temperatures. Paradise is right off of the lake. It's handy for us because on this side of the lake, there is about 30,000 acres of parkland. At the restaurant, we do a massive amount of foraging. We've had a full-time botanist with us for about 4.5 years. The restaurant's been open for 6. We also have a full-time environmental scientist. It is not great. It's not like it's Kansas or Iowa. Kansas, where you have the massive wheat fields, and Iowa, where you have corn that goes for miles and miles. This is a hilly area. The county that we live in is called Clay County. Not the greatest soil, a lot of rocky outcrops. This area was not where, again, out in Kansas back in the of the days when they first started building the railroads, where you had these people were driving down from Texas and Oklahoma out in Kansas. They had the big cattle ranches and would drive the herds of cattle up to Kansas City where the stockyards were. This area really, honestly, has always been about the pig. It was easier to raise bovine here.
Swine.
Pig than it was swine. Thinking that than it was cattle. This was not a big cattle area. It's not a good row crop area. My family on both sides of my family, both my mother and my father, have been in this area for over 170 years.
170. Wow! And you trace that all the way back through books, or is it just carried through the whole family chain?
Oh, it's the property where the restaurant is has been in my family for 173 years, about 3 towns over. My mother's family, who were pig farmers. That farm, my family's bought in 1838, so even 175 years. And so I do have deep roots here, whether I like it or not.
Wow, so fascinating. So tell us about this botanist. Again, I like starting from the terroir and then coming down to you. So you grow up in this, pig-centric, not necessarily good agriculture, but then you have these national parks, these protected areas. What are you foraging in there? What naturally grows in the middle of the country?
How do I even begin with this? I tell you, what grows here is not what grows, say in New York or upstate New York or in Northern California, where I lived for almost 2 decades. It obviously has this very, very particular set of things that grow here. And here even more so, we live in a little area that is called Little Dixie. And when I was growing up, I thought that was talking about more of a term of, social and economic, but it's not. It's really a term of flora and fauna, and flora in particular. The area where we live was formed by the edge of the last great glacier that came down out of the Arctic in Canada. And as this glacier came down, it was like a giant bulldozer. And when it where it stopped and started receding formed the Missouri River. The Missouri River is a very odd river in that it runs for a great distance north and south, and then it gets to the Missouri, Kansas, Nebraska border, which currently is, and just a little bit further south of that, it makes a great bend to the east and runs east and west until it hits the Mississippi River. And that corner was formed by the edge of the glacier as it came down and receded. Well, as the glacier receded, it dropped off the edge of it all kinds of minerals and stones and seeds, for that matter, of plants that were not from this area. Huh. And so there's a belt that runs from where we are a little bit to our west, but more to our east also, that have flora that don't grow in other places around here, and don't actually, a lot of them don't exist up where they originally came from up in Canada anymore.
So it's interesting. You could almost draw a parallel to that, to what kind of Kansas City represents anyway, which is like a kind of connector of everything, because, you know, it was like the center of the meat industry for so long. So it is definitely a meeting point for interesting things. So is that what you forage, these unusual items, and is that what people will see on your menu? I mean, let's start to transition a little bit into the food aspects and how you use it.
Well, there are, you know, things that grow here, obviously. I mean, some of them grow in other places. We used to, literally, I went out into the woods and would gather items. And over time, I started thinking about, well, basically, how efficient or inefficient, I should say, the foraging is. And I'm going to get a little bit to, you know, why we eat what we eat. And when my ancestors and most of the people that live on this continent's ancestors came from Europe, I'm going to even back up further than that, actually. In the rest of the world, when we went from a hunter-gatherer society into an agrarian society, we were gathering food for nutritive, flavor, preservative, medicinal qualities. And as we started to plant these plants that we were eating, that we were gathering in rows as we were moving into an agrarian society, and this happened all around the world, we found plants that had the qualities that we were looking for, and we'd plant the seeds of that particular plant, and we developed the modern cultivars that we have today. When the Europeans came to the Americas and they looked at the Native Americans, they said, well, you're godless heathens, and you're, it's a little pertaining, I guess, to the Indian Easter. They said that you're not, your food is not blessed by Christ or Savior, and that, and therefore not blessed by God, and we're not going to eat what you eat because it's not good Christian food. Mm-hmm. And so we brought everything with us. If you take the small band of potatoes, tomatoes, squash, peppers, and corn out of what we eat today, very little of what we eat is from here. And so there's an entire world of food that is here that is that was always been here. It's never been brought into modern cultivation. So what we're doing now on the property around our house, with the people around us, with Chris Knatzer and Derek Kofelt, we're taking these wild plants and we've planted them on the property, and we're starting to develop our own cultivars.
Hmm. And what are you doing? That's very, very interesting. Tell us, what's the scope of the farm, and does it supply other places other than your restaurant?
Well, the farm is tiny. It's a micro farm. We're using techniques that were actually originally developed to do rooftop gardening in Brooklyn specifically. We're doing a very, very intensively, you know, because of the small area that we're working on. We've got things that are planted of an incredible diversity and as far as proximity, the plants are very, very close together. So we're working on this property where I live, about an acre and a half, although we have another 5-acre property that is dedicated only to the restaurant, and another about 2 acres that is dedicated to the restaurant, but we're in 3 locations. Currently, we are only growing for ourselves, but I think in about another year or two, we are going to have more than we can handle on our own, and we will be selling outside of the restaurant. And we're growing things that some of them are fairly common in this area, epazote, which most people think of as a Mexican herb, is native here, and it's in the same family as goosefoot, which quinoa comes from, and lamb's quarters, and we grow all of those. I think we'll have a viable quinoa crop in probably not, I don't know if this year we may, but next year definitely. We're growing things that you wouldn't even think of about being this area, like wild shiso grows here, bergamot grows here, but they're very different than the cultivars, like, say, that shiso has in Japan or bergamot from the British Isles.
You got to rename it with, like, Trimble. Name one like the Mario or the Nick.
The Nick, you know, that's funny. Nick Fantasma, I had no idea not too long ago. I had someone who was just from Italy, and we were talking about Paradise Meats, and I said something about Nick Fantasma, and this guy started to laugh hilariously, and he says, really? His name is Nick Fantasma? And apparently Nick Fantasma is a famous Italian comic book character, Nick the Ghost.
Oh, well, yes, it's funny, because you know why they were named the Ghost. Mario's grandfather was left at a doorstep, so the people that took him in were like, we'll give him the last name Phantom, because that's who we think brought it. So,
I had no idea. I didn't know that.
That is a funny story. So,
you know, I've known those guys forever, by the way. It's, you know, when, go ahead, I'm sorry.
No. So, we're talking about Paradise Locker Meats, which you can, I think, maybe in 10, 20 years, people will liken to Berkeley, California. For, you know, the heart of the heritage movement. Essentially, if Berkeley is organic movement and heirloom seeds and things of that nature, I think Trimble will actually be known in the Kansas City area as an epicenter for the rare breed genetic diversity movement. And Paradise is right at the center of that because they process, you know, all the beef, all the pigs, all the goats, all the lamb, and even Frank Reese's Good Shepherd Turkey Ranch turkeys come through that facility. So just to contextualize, so tell us what you were going to say. You've known them forever?
I've known them forever. You know, I grew up here, and I couldn't wait to leave here. The day after I graduated from high school, I moved to Southern California because I wanted to go somewhere where I could have complete anonymity, and Los Angeles embodied that for me. And after I realized that no offense to anyone, Angelinos, but after I realized how much I thought Los Angeles sucked, I moved up to San Francisco after graduating from art school and lived in San Francisco a very long time. I was a bicycle messenger in San Francisco for 15 years. And but those guys, you know, used to come back and visit, and they had their back then it was just a meat locker in Paradise. And it's interesting for me to have watched the evolution and the growth of Paradise Meats, because they were this small meat locker that they bought here in this little village of Paradise. And then as they started to realize, you know, maybe what could be possible. And I think, you know, specifically after they met you and after you started to show them, you know, the possibility and the, not just the possibility, but looking at biodiversity and, you know, really, if it weren't for, when you think about the hog, you know, before World War II, the fat on a pig was worth more than the meat was. And that fat was used in munitions and industrial applications and cosmetics. And research and development into petroleum during World War II found replacements for those fats in, you know, petroleum-based products. And after World War II, the market fell out on the hog market, and pig farmers lost their shirts. So the National Pork Association, over the next 50 years, actively sought to breed the fat out of the pig and to homogenize the animal. And by the 1990s, when you had, you know, the pork, the other white meat campaign, there wasn't a restaurant in the country that was serving pork anymore because it was just not any good. Mm-hmm. And if it weren't for these farmers around here specifically that were just bragging rights, and not just around here but around the country, that, you know, that were breeding animals and showing them at county and state fairs, we would have lost these lineages. I mean, this is a long time before the American Livestock Conservancy, you know, that is actively trying to promote biodiversity and animal husbandry. And you mentioned this area. I'm going to back up just a little bit about, hopefully I did think of Smithville as being the Berkeley of the Midwest, actually.
Not Smithville, Trimble.
Well, they're virtually next to each other. You can't. That's like saying College Avenue in Oakland is separated from Berkeley. I mean, they're pretty much, you can't separate the two. But there are a couple of other projects that are going on here that people should check into. The Factor E Farm, that is F-A-C-T-O-R, E Farm, is people from MIT and Cornell and Caltech that have built a farm very near us where they are doing open source technology to help people build the things that you need in a sustainable way and build things that operate in a sustainable way to operate farms. And then there's the Land Institute in Salina, Kansas, which is not very far away at all from Good Shepherd, from Frank Lease's operation.
That's Wes Jackson talking about perennials and the importance of the Earth's food.
Absolutely, absolutely. And this, that's happening right here. And, my wife and I are here not because, believe me, I mean, I was gone a long time. My wife is not from here. And we're not here because we thought we would open this restaurant where we were doing obscure, crazy food in the Midwest because we thought we were going to get rich. We did this because we felt like the change that we thought we could offer, and this is incredibly pretentious, needed to happen here.
So now how are they reacting to it? I mean, I understand what your mission is, because for people who have not been to Justice Drugstore, like one appetizer dish might have 4, 5, 6 things in it, and each one local and each one has a story. I mean, sometimes I mean this in a nice way, the longest part of a meal could be you explaining everything in it, you know, and no, I find that it's a certain type of cuisine, but it's fine dining. It goes in a special place. Now, of course, recently you've opened more of a, I say, quote unquote, lower end snack food place, which means it's really accessible to anyone 7 days a week. But talk about the high end place. It's like going to Daniel Balud or Del Posto. So how is that being reacted to by the locals, who I presume are your main business?
Well, I'm going to give you a two-part answer. One of them is that when we decided to do this here, you know, we'd come visit Kansas City. You know, I lived in San Francisco. Or when we were back, I've lived in France twice. I would say, you know, there are great meals there and there's great ethnic food, but it felt like that on the higher end. And there are, you know, for whatever the beard is worth, I mean, there are five beard winner chef-owned restaurants in Kansas City. And I felt like that the chefs here were afraid to be Midwestern. There was, like, people doing great Italian derivative and doing French derivative, people doing what was happening in New York 5 years ago. But it never felt like I had a meal here that was about here. And when we opened the restaurant, I said, you know, I'm going to do food that is culturally and geographically about here, and I call it country food on steroids. And now I think, you know, doing regional food has become, in a very short time, a very big thing. But I, you know, when you started this, I don't think anyone was doing, you know, what they would call oat Midwestern, or, you know, or there's the Southern Food Alliance, but there's really nothing like that in this area. And so we started thinking about, well, what does that entail? But what about truffles? They don't say anything about here. Lobster doesn't say anything about here, or capers. So we started actively looking to develop resources and develop products that we felt were about here. So we've been, for the past, especially since we started the farm, looking at things like, what can we pickle that would be a replacement that would get us, like, the brininess of say, a caper? And we've been looking at bee balm as kind of what we've honed in on that seems to work really well, which is the fourth and the three sister plants, actually. But when we first opened, I wasn't really sure how we were going to be accepted, but I get a lot of people that look at the menu and they kind of freak out because they've never seen anything like it. And honestly, not even just from here, I have people from New York or from Dakota, from San Francisco or Chicago that look at the menu and say, this is not like any menu I've seen. But the locals, when they tasted it, they said, this has this, you know, it feels familiar, but it's manifested in a way that I've never seen before, which may not be the actual term steak, some fried pork, tenderloins, but I'm not talking about that country food. I'm talking about the country food before World War II, which changed everything as far as the way we eat, in particular, well, not just in the Midwest, but everywhere in this country. But when my great-grandfather on my mother's side, you know, when they harvested a pig, they ate everything it wasn't because they were trying to do cool nose to tail. It's because you had to. I mean, you had to eat everything on it. And you had to can and pickle and preserve because if you were going to get through the winter, you hadn't have any kind of variety in your meal. It had to come from the summertime. And the winters here can be very, very harsh. So when we opened, we knew that was going to be a big part of what we're doing. We do all of our own canning, pickling, and drying. We are extremely busy over the summer. And I had to actually build a separate building to house everything that we preserve over the summer to start using out over the winter. So, you know, right now I have a salad that has pickled blueberries that that were from last summer's bounty. I've got blackberries on my menu also at the moment that were local wild black raspberries, service berries. Although it's not native, we use I love autumn olive berries. I try to collect as many as possible because they're not native and they are invasive. So I feel the more that I use, that maybe I can slow the spread a little bit.
Very, very interesting. So now, do you hunt?
I'm sorry. Do I hunt?
Yeah. And fish. What do you have? You have a crappie,
I have a
right?
BB gun.
You have a BB gun. That's a no. So crappie, right? Is that the main fish in Smithville Lake?
No. Yeah, it is. You know, I love crappie. It is such an amazing fish. And from the beginning, I didn't plan on doing seafood because, you know, when I get on the roof here, I don't see an ocean. And my background is seafood. Before here, I was an executive chef in the south of France, right on the Mediterranean. Before that, I was working in Paris. And before that, I was executive chef of a place called the Liberties in San Francisco. My background is seafood. But it doesn't make any sense. If you want to do food about here, I mean, what do scallops or oysters or lobster or crab say about Kansas City? Absolutely nothing. But you're right, crappie.
Well, I always like to say crappie is the shit and porgy is the best.
Crappie is so good. It is such an amazing fish, and I wish we could farm raise it. Unfortunately, its feed to output ratio is something like 17-1. They are voracious appetites for the amount that they grow, and unfortunately, trying to raise them commercially is not viable. Seemingly anyway.
Let me ask you this: then you are part of a new breed of basically you're slow fooding a place that had only had fast food franchises open over the past 50 years. So can you name two or three other contemporaries of yours in the Kansas City area who you admire and think are doing great things? Because we always like to say all boats rise with the high tide. So there is more than just you in Smithville. Can you just speak to other places that you eat and that you respect in your area?
Yeah, you know, Howard Hanna has a place called the Rieger Hotel. They and ourselves also do extreme handcrafted cocktails from local ingredients. Howard spent quite a bit of time in Manhattan. He was first in his class at the CIA in a four-year program and was at Gramercy Tavern and Union Square Cafe. And his restaurant is a little bit more of maybe a little bit more of an Italian derivative, although it's definitely food about the Midwest. I think he's doing some great food. Colby Girls, who is nominated 7 times for a beard, I really hope he wins this year. He deserves to.
He's like the Susan Lucci of James Beard. She never won.
He is, and if he heard this conversation, he would kick my ass, but it's absolutely true. He knows it, but his restaurant, Blue Sim, I think they, from when they opened, which was a couple of years before we got back from France, he was kind of dabbling in the idea of food about the Midwest, and his restaurant, Bluestem, and recently opened a restaurant that is definitely much more purist than we are, because it's just down home country food. He's opened a restaurant called Rye that is quite good. I think over at the American, there's a woman, Debbie Gold, who is a great chef that spent her time at Charlie Trotter's up in New York before. In Chicago.
Yeah. Now,
before coming here,
the American was Joe Baum's restaurant, right? The American was right. Joe Baum's restaurant, very old American restaurant.
Absolutely. Out of that restaurant, Bradley Ogden in San Francisco was discovered by Julia Child at the American probably 30 years ago, maybe 35 years ago. And also in town, someone that's a little bit less heralded, her food is fabulous, is Jennifer Maloney, who spent time cooking with Mario Batali back on the West Coast many, many years ago when they were young and when they were in their 20s. And she...
Cafe Sebastian?
Absolutely. You know your Kansas City restaurants. Yeah, you know, it's a really... Her food is solid. It's really good. And like I said, I don't think she doesn't get the... because it's in a museum, maybe she doesn't get quite the attention to some of the other restaurants, but that's a great restaurant. Best brunch in Kansas City, for sure.
And then I hear, of course, Lydia Bastianich, we mustn't forget, the grandmother of Italian cuisine. And then there's this guy, Beard, Michael Beard, right, who's in Lawrence, who uses...
Michael Beard is 715 over in Lawrence, which is a little further out of the Kansas City market than I am, but definitely still part of the same market. And he's doing great food over in Lawrence, Kansas, which is maybe the only serious liberal bastion in that state.
Wow. All right. Look at you getting in a little politics there. Well, Mario Fantasma just clicked off the internet.
That's right.
But anyway, I do very much appreciate you taking time. I know you were probably up late last night. I love your restaurant. I was just on a tour with 8 chefs, and of course we stopped at your restaurant and had an appetizer extravaganza, and I recommend everybody to fly to Kansas City, go to the agriturismos that exist there, and visit Paradise, eat at Justice and these other great restaurants. Kansas City is a great town. It's growing. Downtown is growing. It's evolving. It seems to be on the upswing, not like so many cities, which unfortunately seem to be on the downswing. So thanks so much for being on, and please send my regards to your lovely wife. And are you open today?
No, we're... like I said, we are on the northern edge, but we are on the Bible Belt. I could be open, but no one would show up. We had staff over for a party last night, and up here on the farm, and when it started getting light out, I said, "Hey, I got a radio interview. I got to go to bed."
Now, do you have a website, Jonathan?
We do. It's It's drugstorerestaurant.com. You Google Justice Drugstore, and that's Justice JUS. TUS, there are reams of information about us out there.
Well, thank you so much. I want to also thank Joe, of course, for engineering a lovely show. And I want to thank White Oak Pastures for sponsoring us and for providing great grass-fed beef to people along the East Coast. And we will be back next week. Stay tuned for a live episode of Straight No Chaser with Katie Kiefer.
Great talking to you, Patrick. Have a good day.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.